top stories, Israeli warplanes attack the Gaza Strip, targeting several areas in the besieged Palestinian territory. Lebanese government decides to raise fuel prices in a bid to ease crippling shortage that has brought the country to a standstill. Hurricane Grace unleashes severe flooding and mudslides in Mexico, leaving at least 8 people dead. Welcome to the program. Israeli warplanes have pounded at least 3 targets in the besieged Gaza Strip. The regime claimed the airstrikes were in response to a protest, marking the 52nd anniversary of the burning of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Our correspondent, Arashaf Shannon, joined us earlier with an update.
Israeli fighter jets attacked at least 3 areas in the Gaza Strip. They started by attacking the new fisherman pier in the west of the central Gaza Strip refugee camp of Al Buraj, and they also attacked an area near the Gaza Sol power generating plant, and also attacked an area in southern Gaza city itself. At least 2 of these places the Hamas military wing, Qassam Brigade's training centers that are located close to those areas that were attacked by Israeli fighter jets. The Israeli regime claims that these attacks were retaliation for the protests that were taking place earlier today as Palestinians marked the 52nd anniversary of the torching of Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds by an Australian Zionist fanatic.
More than 40 Palestinians, including 22 children, are injured as Israeli forces open fire on protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The protesters called for an end to the Israeli siege of the Gaza Strip. Health officials said 2 Palestinians and an Israeli soldier were injured seriously. Demonstrators were also marking the 52nd anniversary of the burning of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by an extremist Australian Christian. Marking the occasion, the office of President Mahmoud Abbas called on the international community to protect the holy sites in Al-Quds.
The National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip commemorated the 52nd anniversary of Al-Aqsa Mosque burning by holding a huge rally along the separating border East Gaza. Al-Aqsa Mosque was burned by an extremist Jew in 1969. Palestinian factions expressed their condemnation of Israel's long history of crimes against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Today marks the 52nd anniversary of the burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque. This incident shows the true nature of this occupation. Palestinians here vow to continue their battle against this occupation across all occupied lands. We remain united in this endless battle with all possible means.
This rally comes in conjunction with the current Israeli violations in Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Israeli regime is imposing the policy of eviction and displacement of Palestinians and keeping their killing and land-grabbing operations in an attempt to Jewidize Al-Quds and get rid of its people.
Palestinians have gathered here to assert the unity of all Palestinians in the face of occupation. Palestinians are here to say no to any Israeli attempts to Judaize the Palestinian lands. Palestinians won't accept any violation against Al-Quds, and the resistance will go on until liberation of all Palestine.
The resistance declared it won't allow Israel to violate Palestinian sanctities and keep the blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip, as they agreed to activate the popular resistance and the return of clashes by the separation fence, stressing they won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes.
Palestinians have proved that they will keep their resistance in the face of all Israeli projects that aim to demolish the Palestinian identity. Al-Quds is the symbol of our history. Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque are our red lines, and we won't accept any Israeli violation of our holy sites. Israeli regime must be held accountable for any action against Al-Quds.
52 years after Al-Aqsa Mosque was set ablaze, Palestinians here call for defending Al-Quds with all possible means until its complete freedom from occupation. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
In other news, the International Criminal Court has added new cases of Palestinian homes demolished by Israel to its probe into the regime's war crimes. The International Tribunal said it will review the Israeli military's razing of several structures in the village of Khirbat Humsa in the occupied Jordan Valley. The cases were sent to the ICC by Israeli NGO Combatants for Peace. Former ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda opened a war crime probe into Israel's actions from 2014 and onwards. The regime's settlement construction, razing of Palestinian homes, and military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip are among the issues under investigation. Bruno Biclini, professor of international relations, joins us via Skype out of Porto Alegre in Brazil. Thank you very much, Professor. How significant of a move would you say the ICC Act is?
Well, this proves for the international community, for the international system, that Israel, the Zionist entity, is an apartheid state. They are promoting ethnic cleansing since the late 20s. They never said nothing different from this. And we can prove, as international studies scholars, that the state of Israel is composed majority by European invaders who are still invading the Jordan Valley, Al-Quds, the West Bank, sieging Gaza, and also inside the occupied territories in 1948, they are promoting apartheid. I can barely imagine what would happen if it was promoted by the de Klerk regime, Peter Botha regime, in the old South African apartheid, because it's quite the same.
How hopeful are you, Professor, that actually acts like these will have bear some tangible results for the cause of the Palestinians?
This depends a lot on public opinion inside the Western countries and inside U.S. and Canada, but especially here in the United States, because we could say that without United States support, infinite support for Israel, they could never proceed during an apartheid regime like they are doing. But also, the most important thing is not to rely on ICC. It's important, but the most important thing is to rely on the Palestinian Arabic diaspora. For example, here in Brazil, we have 60 million people from Arab descendants who are still very vinculated to the Bilad Hashem and to liberating Palestine, securing Lebanon, and liberating Syria from the Salafist invaders. So it's more dependent on us and the acts of resistance than more on the ICC. But the ICC is very important, too, to the public opinion. And they are very afraid of ICC. They established the Ministry of Strategic Affairs to go on war, cybernetic war, on social networks in the Internet and public diplomacy. So they are afraid of ICC. So it's a good news.
Bruno Biclini, professor of international relations out of Porto Alegre, Brazil. Thank you very much for your time. Lebanon's government has decided to increase the exchange rate used as a base for fuel imports. Central Bank Governor Riyad Salama said the government will raise the exchange rate used to price fuel to 8,000 pounds per dollar from the previous level of 3,900 pounds to the dollar. The government says the decision is to ease the country's crippling fuel shortages. President Michel Aoun said the government treasury will bear the cost of the continuation of fuel subsidies. Earlier, the UN Children's Fund warned that millions of people in Lebanon could face a critical shortage of water soon due to the fuel crisis. Lebanon's fuel crisis worsened earlier this month when the central bank said it could no longer finance fuel imports at heavily subsidized exchange rates and would switch to market rates. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Soleh, says the current fuel crisis in the country is unprecedented, and the government hopes that the new measures, or measure that is, yield result.
Basically, we reached a state where the crisis is unprecedented. It's very much dire, more than any time in the past. So therefore, the government had asked for more subsidies and more funds to be given to the shipments of fuel that are coming into Lebanon. The governor of the central bank had refused, saying that we have absolutely no more reserves. We cannot tap on the reserves in order to pay that amount. Therefore, President Michel called for an urgent meeting today. And that is where they came to a compromise, if you may say. They decided to basically liberate the price of fuel, not keeping it to the original rate price. We're talking about 3,900 lira per dollar for the barrels of fuel that are coming in. That was the price that that was a subsidized price that the central bank could not pay. So therefore, they decided to upgrade that price and make it based on the market, but not completely the market. It is somewhat less than what we see in the black market. So this is why they decided upon 8,000 lira per dollar.
The United States and Germany have advised their nationals in Afghanistan to avoid traveling to the Kabul airport. The two countries cited security risks outside the airport gates as the reason for issuing the warning. The U.S. and European countries are trying to evacuate their citizens as well as Afghans who worked for NATO forces. The EU says it is impossible to pull out all allied Afghans. By the end of August, thousands of people have gathered outside the airport for a week trying to get a flight out. The Taliban have urged those without travel documents to go home. At least 12 people have been killed in and around the single runway airfield since Sunday. The Taliban say they plan to unveil a new model for governing Afghanistan within the next few weeks. They also emphasize the importance of holding a wide range of consultations with other political leaders. The move has been welcomed by political circles in Afghanistan. Amin Alami is in Kabul.
Taliban leaders are busy in these days as they are facing the challenge of good governance in Afghanistan. To this end, they have decided to pick up some key steps to prove their capabilities by unveiling a new framework for governance within next days. The Taliban say they aim to keep up consultations with former high-ranking officials, prominent political leaders, and the rest of political activists in order to establish an inclusive government.
We want to establish a government in which all sides, including political groups, ethnic groups, and religious groups, have their share in. We are trying to reach an agreement with other sides in this regard. We are not after war. We are seeking peace and calm for our country.
In the meantime, top Afghan political leaders urged the Taliban to continue its efforts to attract more local and international support. This will not happen, they warn, unless the Taliban listen to the voice of people.
I do not expect the peace plan developed entirely by the U.S. to be fruitful. Therefore, regional countries need to take the initiative and work together on the issue, or at least put pressure on the U.S. to work honestly.
Taliban war comes as thousands of Afghans seek to get out of their country via Kabul International Airport since Taliban took control over the city almost a week ago. The rising number of horrified people in and around the airport has created a big chaos there, resulting to the death of 12 so far. Two of the victims, including a member of Afghanistan's national football team, lost their lives after they fell from this flying U.S. military aircraft. The incident shocked the entire world. Taliban say they plan to investigate reported cases of atrocities by the members against civilians, including journalists. Taliban are going to set up separate teams for dealing with Afghanistan's internal security and financial crisis as well. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Thousands have taken to the streets in central London to protest the takeover of Afghanistan by Taliban militants. Several thousands people marched toward the residence and office of Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the capital. The protesters also voiced solidarity with Afghans opposed to the militants' control over the country. The UK Premier has come under sharp criticism over his government's handling of the crisis in Afghanistan. Thousands of Afghans have been trying to flee Kabul since the Taliban took control of the city on August the 14th. Hurricane Grace has pummeled Mexico with torrential rain, causing severe flooding and mudslides that killed at least 8 people. The government said 6 of the casualties belonged to a single family. Grace was whipping up maximum sustained winds of over 200 kilometers per hour when it hit the resort of Tecolutla in Veracruz state in the early morning. Early in the week, Grace pounded Mexico's Caribbean coast, downing trees and leaving nearly 700,000 people without electricity. It, however, did not cause any loss of life. A recent UN report says nearly 21 million Yemenis are in a dire humanitarian situation and that their condition is getting worse day by day. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has more.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen is worsening amid the ongoing Saudi war and siege. A recent report by the United Nations Population Fund suggests that 20.7 million Yemenis require humanitarian assistance, while over a million pregnant and breastfeeding women are projected to suffer from acute malnutrition throughout 2021. The COVID-19 pandemic, along with the torrential rain and the currency collapse, has also contributed to the deterioration of the already catastrophic humanitarian situation in Yemen, the report said. For instance, by the end of June 2021, nearly 7,000 cases of COVID-19 and more than 1,300 associated deaths had been reported amid concerns that the real number of infections were being underreported. Earlier, the United Nations reported that it had only received half of what was required for the humanitarian response plan of 2021, which was estimated at $3.85 million, despite donors stepping up their support compared to 2020. Observers say Yemen will continue to face a devastating humanitarian situation that risks turning into famine if the international community does not act urgently. They say the only solution is to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege imposed on millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel, after calling the scenes in Kabul bitter, dramatic and terrifying, announced she would look for ways to secure possibilities for refugees in the neighbourhood of Afghanistan, that is, somewhere that is not inside Europe. We now present you an article written by Daniel Williams, a former foreign correspondent for the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times and Miami Herald, and an ex-researcher for Human Rights Watch. The piece is titled Afghan Refugee Crisis Headed for Europe. Unsettling images of thousands of Afghans storming Kabul airport to force their way onto planes out of the country put European officials on notice that a refugee crisis was looming. That suggests that, like US President Joe Biden, they had no notion that a quick and complete Taliban takeover of Afghanistan was likely, and what that might mean. First, those involved in NATO's two-decade intervention in Afghanistan, along with other European Union countries, are focused on getting their own citizens and Afghan collaborators out of the country. That exodus is underway. But in European capitals, officials also quickly turned to another paramount concern: how to avert a flow of tens of thousands of desperate refugees to their borders and avoid the political fallout that might arise from uncontrolled immigration. European Union ministers are scheduled to meet on the subject in the coming days. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, after calling the scenes in Kabul bitter, dramatic and terrifying, announced she would look for ways to secure possibilities for refugees in the neighbourhood of Afghanistan, that is, somewhere that is not inside Europe. French President Emmanuel Macron warned that Europeans must protect ourselves against major irregular migratory flows. The cold attitude reflects an anti-migration turn in Europe spanning 6 years. Gone is the so-called grand gesture of Angela Merkel's 2015 invitation for refugees, mostly from Syria, Iraq and Afghanistan, to come to Europe. 1 million crossed Greece and the Balkans and into Germany. But Germany's difficulties in absorbing the newcomers, plus Angela Merkel's demand that other European nations also take them in, created a surge of opposition to immigration. The upswell led to several anti-establishment electoral victories. Notably, Brexit referendum campaigners exploited Germany's open-door policy to whip up immigration fears. So the welcome mat is being pulled in recent days as the Taliban closed in on Kabul. Germany, Denmark, the Netherlands, Austria, Belgium and Greece asked the European Commission they be allowed to continue deportations of Afghans already in Europe, but whose asylum requests have been denied. With the Afghan government out and the Taliban insurgents in, the question is moot for now. Angela Merkel is not repeating her blanket invitation. France is demanding the European Union decide together. The United Kingdom said only it will design a selective, bespoke approach to accepting asylum seekers. The leaders of Italy's two most popular parties, both nationalists, said the country should let in none. Hungary and Bulgaria announced they will not accept refugees. Leventa Maghiar, Hungary's deputy foreign minister, said Budapest would not pay for the flawed geopolitical decision of the United States and NATO in Afghanistan. The election calendars of the European Union's two leading countries, Germany and France, explained their reticence. German national elections, in which Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union, CDU party, is trying to maintain its dominant position in parliament, are set for next month. Merkel is not running. Emmanuel Macron faces a stiff challenge from nationalist rival Marine Le Pen in next year's French presidential vote. Scenes on Sunday, 15th of August, of hundreds of Afghans cramming into a U.S. military cargo plane and the sight of a pair of men falling from the sky after losing their grip on landing gear added urgency to European worries. But crisis possibilities were building long before. According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, since January, about 400,000 Afghan civilians have been displaced by combat. There were about 250,000 of them since May, when fighting picked up, and 2 weeks after Joe Biden announced Americans' pullout of Afghanistan. Austria is already deploying its army to its eastern border to block migrants. Greece started to build a fence along its land border and install noisemaking technology to deter refugees. And Hungary's president, Viktor Orban, built a similar barrier in 2015. He was vilified as a racist. No one's raising a ruckus now. Meanwhile, Turkey, a non-EU country but a major way stop on the land route to Europe, is making it clear it does not want to host Afghan migrants seeking asylum elsewhere. It has played that role during Syria's long war and hosts more than 3 million refugees, most of them from Syria. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan rejected American and German proposals that asylum seekers wait there while their petitions are being processed. Turkey is building a concrete wall along its border with Iran, through which Afghans are passing from the east. In recent weeks, 27,000 Afghans crossed Turkey's border on their way to Europe, presidential spokesman Fahrettin Altun declared. Turkey does not and will not serve as any country's waiting room. We will continue to do everything in our power to preserve the safety of our borders. Since 2015, more than 550,000 Afghan refugees have sought asylum in the European Union. They are the second biggest group of asylum seekers after Syrians. In the past 5 years, the European Union quietly moved to seal its eastern frontiers with fences, while drones routinely scan the borders. The chances of getting asylum vary from country to country. According to the Washington Post, positive recognition of Afghan asylum claims range from a high of 94% in Italy to only 4% in Bulgaria. Germany accepted 44% of requests, while Belgium accepted 32%. Outside the European Union, besides Turkey, Iran and Pakistan host more than 3 million refugees each. Pakistan says it will permit Afghans access to refugee camps near the border, but only temporarily. Iran is setting up refugee camps on the border and is accepting newcomers warmly and requesting them to return home when Afghanistan calms down. Besides the chaos at Kabul airport, television news and the internet have been full of Afghan worries of coming repression under the Taliban. The warnings come mostly from people who benefited from the so-called nation-building efforts of the United States and Europeans in Afghanistan. Teachers, professionals, government workers, and especially women, but they're not on the list of those who worked for NATO forces or non-governmental organizations, NGOs. They will not gain easy access abroad as the airlift from Kabul ramps up. Will those left behind face the repression under Taliban rule that characterized their previous 1996 to 2001 reign in the country? That period included oppression of women, prohibitions on educating girls, as well as punishment of men who resisted strict religious practices imposed by the Taliban. Sports and music were banned in Afghanistan. Beards and religious chanting were required. But the possibility of those days returning is not much on the minds of Europeans right now. Controlling migration is.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haidar. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
It's great to have you here. We've been discussing about the Iranian election system, and we've been talking about how the Western propaganda is often attacking Iran. Lots and lots of interesting points that Sheikh Ali and Sayyid Mahdi brought up last time about the personality of Sayyid Raisi. I'd like to actually evolve this discussion a bit more now, taking it to Sayyid Mahdi, inshallah. This idea of Iran having an election process, right, and then the Western powers attacking it. We mentioned how the Western media is attacking and how they've got a history of doing this. Why do they do it again?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's interesting, in one of the previous programs we talked about some of the reasons on why this Western propaganda or the mass media of the West in general has attacked these democratic elections in the Islamic Republic of Iran. One of the things that comes to mind is the fact that the neoliberal or liberal democratic systems of the world, the Western world, they do not want this Islamic Republic system to spread beyond the borders of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So this Islamic Republic system, which again is based upon Islam, based upon the Quran, it's based upon the traditions of the Holy Prophet, this system of the Islamic Republic, again, which was put forth by Imam Khomeini, I'm giving due credit to everywhere where it should be given.
Mm-hmm.
And then this Islamic Republic, which has been sustained and continued and strengthened by Imam Khamenei, this system is something which is a very serious threat to this global hegemony of the Western world and of imperialist colonialist powers. And so this, in my mind, is one of the reasons why... One of the reasons why they are really doing as much as they can to make the system and the elections and the whole thing seem like a sham.
You know, I just wanted to point out that it's not just the West. Back then, it was the communist power in the East as well. Now, the Soviet Union has fallen, and the big bad guy in today's world is the Western power, right? Is the great Satan, America, and its cohorts.
If I can add right there to this thought and build on top of it. See, we back in the day, we had this liberal democracy as a model of governance. Then the Russia, USSR, you know, the Soviet, they had the communism as the working model, right? Communist government, communism has its own ideology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
These were the only two blocks or only two options for the countries of the world to choose from.
Yes, and right? Every other country was basically just choosing, should I side with them, should I side with them? Should I go into their pocket or their pocket?
Right, so there were these two camps, and you can either join them or you can just take parts of their system and implement in your country and run your country. This was the option, the only two options. What the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution and the concept and the belief of Wilayatul Faqih did, at least for the Muslim nations, is to present a third option. Okay, this is huge. When you're looking at the world at a macro level, this is huge. You're providing a political system, a method of governing your country and deciding your own fate. This option did not exist before. And why I said at least Muslim countries, because I personally believe, and I have logical reasoning for that, why this system is also applicable and viable and feasible for non-Muslim countries. And I know right off the bat people are not going to agree with me, but this is something that I can discuss. I'm ready to prove in my own way.
I would love to discuss that. Yeah. Because
this is the only divine solution in the time of the occultation of Imam. Again, I don't want to go on a tangent, right?
Yeah, yeah.
When the Imam comes, we're going to have Imam Mahdi, Ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. He's going to be ruling the world.
Mm-hmm.
That one world, inshallah, one government, right? In his occultation, I still think that the divine principles of Islam can benefit all the nations out there, not just the Muslim nations.
That again, is an absolutely beautiful thought that you said. And it is a bit of a tangent, but Sayyid Mehdi, I think you'd agree that it's a beautiful tangent.
Yeah, of course, right? So when we talk about Islam in itself as a, you know, as an existence or as a being, so Islam, all of the tenets and the basic principles and the concepts and the ideas and the philosophy, the ethics, the morality, the laws, all of these things that are within Islam are
social
universal.
Social justice system, mm-hmm.
Justice, right? And really, if you were to implement this thing, Islam, on a global level, you will find that it promotes truth and justice and equality, and that's something that is universal.
I
just wanted to add something that was really interesting about this political theory, this third political theory that was brought forth by Imam Khomeini in an era where you had two global superpowers, the communists and the capitalists, against each other. It seems like history tends to repeat itself. Now, how true that is, I don't know. It's something that can be researched. But the thing that came immediately to my mind, you know, with all due respect to each on its own, was during the time of the Holy Prophet when Islam came forth. You had two global superpowers at that time as well, right? You had the Romans on one side, and you had the Persians on the other side. And either the world had sided with the Persians, or the world had sided with the Romans. There was no third.
Yeah, or had been dominated by
or had been dominated yeah. by either one of these two. And then you had this Islam come forth in the middle. And again, Islam wasn't just limited to that area. It was a global phenomenon. So I thought that was an interesting thing to add to this.
Yeah, point. And just to add to that as well, it's interesting how once Islam rose, the Eastern Bloc, in other words, the Persian Empire, kind of fizzled away in history. It's the Romans that actually remained for the longest time. The same thing has happened after the Islamic Revolution, where the Eastern Bloc, represented by the Soviet Union, kind of disappeared. It actually collapsed. And now we're dealing with the same old thing, the Western power. Yeah, coming back to this idea of Imam Khomeini, Islam, in fact, having presented an alternate to the entire world for a feasible socio-political system that can have an effect, you know, it can be put into effect, in fact, across the world. And as you mentioned, even in non-Muslim countries, what stands out really profoundly is the fact that they attacked the concept of Sharia from the onset. You know, I don't know how much it was in the US, but in the UK, we had this whole thing about, you know, Sharia laws coming to the UK. And, you know, they created a whole hoo-ha and the propaganda was massive. And people were trying to explain that, hold on, Sharia isn't as bad as you think it is. But people are terrified of it. They're actually terrified of Sharia. But that's actually what, at least a part of what we're talking about being implemented.
I want to, because this is interesting, and then I'll pass it over to Sheikh Ali. So I've been following this kind of idea of what you just talked about at least since September 11th, 2001, okay? So we are right now, what, 2021. I've been following this concept since 2001, so over 20 years at least.
You don't look that old.
No, thank you, yeah. I'm actually, like, you know, close to 50 years old, but... what's interesting here is that in the last 20 years, not only have they attacked the Sharia, right, this divine legislation of God, okay, you will find that there are a lot of Islamic so-called symbols or things that are connected with Islam which have been attacked in the last 20 years, right? So whether it's an individual who wears a turban, whether it's an individual who wears a black turban, whether it's a person who wears religious clothes, whether it's a person as simple as somebody who has a beard. Now, these things that I'm listing are things that have been demonized and have been showed in a negative context in the Western global media empire for the last two decades, over 20 years. A person having a beard, a person wearing a turban, a woman wearing a hijab, a woman wearing a burqa. Hold
quickly,
on. There's terms like Islam, Islamic State, Mujahideen, Taliban. Look, Mujahideen is somebody who fights and strives on the path of God. Mm-hmm. This is a Mujahideen. They took it to these crazy Taliban. Taliban is from Talabe. Talabe is a student.
Mm.
you know, in our context, an Islamic seminary student, right?
Absolutely.
They took this terminology, Islamic State and the Levant, right? So for example, you have an Islamic Republic, they took Islamic State and they turned it around. The Caliph, right? Abu Bakr Baghdadi, he was known as the Caliph of the Islamic State. They have taken so many terminologies of Islam and demonized it in order to scare. And why? If you look at 2001, Islam was at that point the fastest growing religion in the world, including the Western world. And that is
absolutely
when these attacks started. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to make an additional observation because you mentioned the black turban. But did you notice that Takfiri Wahhabis, generally speaking, it is not a recognized symbol of Takfiri Wahhabism to actually wear a turban. However, they had a white turban on Osama bin Laden and a black one on Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, if you look at Boko Haram, that guy, Abu Bakr Shekau, who I think he committed suicide because another Daesh group was going to take over, he used to wear a black turban. It's really weird. I mean,
it has been an orchestrated attack, like just visually, to bring the attention to Iran. So,
again, it's the phobia, right? The point is that these are the fear-mongering techniques, right? Because what happens with general masses is they get scared, right? And when anything we're scared of, we're going to avoid it, right? So if you get scared of, let's say, an Islamic government, quote-unquote, right, you are not going to put together an Islamic government, build an infrastructure for it, implement the rules of Islam, and because you're scared, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is basically what they tried to do with all of these things, and now they're trying to do it with Iran. Iran being a nuclear state, building bombs, that's all they show, right? Why do they show this? So they freak people out. They scare people off. And when people get scared and nations get scared and countries get scared, they are repellent to that idea. In this case, the Islamic Republic of Iran. They're not going to engage in business transactions. They're not going to engage in trade.
Let alone consider adopting that political system.
Exactly, right? So this is the tactic that they're using, which our people need to, inshallah, understand and realize.
I mean, to just to continue your train of thought, this inculcating and injecting fear into the masses, it is a very easy way for governments and powers to control their people, right? If you consistently have your population under fear, right, fear causes certain amounts of stress. Imam Khamenei says that people who are cowards, meaning they have fear, they don't have the right to talk about rationality. Meaning what? It means that fear creates an irrationality, an instability in people, and then what happens is you manipulate the vote. You manipulate the vote to an extent where you can manipulate the people due to fear to vote for somebody, as racist as Donald Trump, for example. It is fear, either fear from this side, fear from that side, fear from Muslims, fear from black people, fear from Hispanics, fear from immigrants, fear from the Antifa. And so this is interesting. Islam is the exact opposite. It promotes courage and bravery, and it does. In just one tradition from the Holy Prophet, he says that even if you look at another Muslim in a manner which scares them, this is considered a sin.
Subhanallah.
Let alone Daesh and these crazy guys.
That's all we have time for, unfortunately. A fascinating discussion, inshallah, which we will be continuing, inshallah, next time. From myself and from our honorable guests, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taken my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today. Yeah. Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Western technocrat, would-be populist, wartime president, Ashraf Ghani tried to inhabit many roles during his years as Afghanistan's president. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Matthew Rosenberg and Adam Nossiter. The piece is titled, After 7 years of failing to fix Afghanistan, Ghani makes a hasty escape. Western technocrat, would-be populist, wartime president, Ashraf Ghani tried to inhabit many roles during his years as Afghanistan's president. But after fleeing the Taliban's advance into Kabul this weekend, Ashraf Ghani, wherever he is stepping into a far less welcome role, that of a failed leader whose hasty escape from Kabul scuttled negotiations to ensure a smooth transition to power to the Taliban, and left his own people to deal with the deadly chaos and frightening uncertainty under the country's once and future rulers. As of Monday, 16th of August, it was not even clear where Ashraf Ghani was or would end up living. Close aides could not be reached by phone. Some reports suggested that he had gone to neighboring Uzbekistan or Tajikistan, or perhaps even to Oman. There was talk that Saudi Arabia had agreed to give him asylum, and rumors that he had been accompanied by as many as 200 aides, ministers and parliament members. There were also reports that Ashraf Ghani had fled with piles of cash and questions about whether the United States played any role in his departure. It was an ignominious turn for a World Bank-trained technocrat who holds a doctorate from Columbia University and, as he often reminded people, wrote a book titled Fixing Failed States. Instead of fixing Afghanistan during his nearly 7 years in power, Ashraf Ghani fled, much the way he governed, isolated from all but a handful of advisers, who are said to have departed with him. The fallout was swift at what semblance of civil government that was left in Kabul melted away, and thousands of Afghans stormed through Kabul International Airport, the city's sole connection to the outside world, desperate to find a way out. But unlike Ashraf Ghani, almost all of them had no chance of getting out, and several people died in the chaos. Mr. Ghani, a 72-year-old, defended his decision to bolt in a social media post late on Sunday, writing from an undisclosed location that, if I had stayed, countless of my countrymen would be martyred and Kabul would face destruction. Others, though, condemned his flight as a desperate act of self-preservation by a man whose failure had paved the way for the Taliban's return nearly 20 years to the month after the U.S.-led invasion that led to their ouster following the 9/11 attacks. He will be known as the Benedict Arnold of Afghanistan. People will be spitting on his grave for another 100 years, said Saad Mohseni, who owns one of Afghanistan's most popular television stations, Tolu TV. Mr. Mohseni was part of a last-ditch effort to save Kabul from a violent and bloody takeover by the Taliban, working with former President Hamid Karzai and others to negotiate an interim arrangement that would give the Taliban a week or two to take the reins of Afghanistan's government. The effort collapsed once word got out that Ashraf Ghani had fled the country, whereupon the Taliban began moving into Kabul in force. Some were even pictured sitting at the same desk from which Ashraf Ghani had only days ago tried to rally his faltering military to resist the Taliban. He's a coward, and him leaving this vacuum is the reason why we have what we have today, Mr. Mohseni said in a telephone interview from London. The scenes at Kabul airport and people getting killed are his doing. One of Ashraf Ghani's former ministers was similarly blunt, writing in a text message, "I wonder how he can live with such betrayal of his own people." Ashraf Ghani's time in power in many ways came to mirror the failed international effort to rebuild Afghanistan into a modern state with regular elections, a Western-style financial system, and a military built on an American model. The latter was a pricey endeavor, heavy on logistics and advanced weaponry, in a country with little expertise in either one. Like that effort, Ashraf Ghani's approach faltered time and time again. He was a policy wonk at heart, who had a penchant for conducting small talk in a vernacular best described as technocraties. Think phrases like consultative processes and cooperative frameworks. It made him a successful finance minister in the years after 2001 and a darling of Western officials. He was looked to, hopefully, as the man who could clean up Afghanistan's corrupt and often non-functional government after he was declared the victor of a highly disputed election back in 2014. Ashraf Ghani too insisted that his reasoned analyst approach would overcome centuries of ethnic division, spoil-seeking and tribal hatred in Afghanistan's politics. Yet he at times also sought to play the populist, talking tough about American interference in his country and sometimes showing up at rallies clad like a village chief, in a heavy turban and thick robes that dwarfed his slight frame. He embraced warlords he had once insisted Afghanistan needed to be rid of if it was to flourish, and he took anger management classes to get his temper in check. But as the years in power wore on and turmoil festered, and the government failed to bend to his intellect, he isolated himself in Kabul's sprawling presidential palace, rising at 5 a.m. to read 600-page reports, bringing to bear his training as an anthropologist. While no one doubted Ashraf Ghani's own firmly held conviction about his outsized intellect, it did little to help him manage the endless palaver of Afghan politics, with its power brokers, ethnic divisions, and reliance on outright bribery to get things done. His temper and tendency to lecture did not make matters any better. He neglected his American-backed army, leaving his soldiers in the field hungry. The military turned out to be a mere facade, crumbling as soon as the Taliban exerted pressure. He treated warlords who could have fought for him with contempt and condescension. They too put up little resistance as the Taliban swept across Afghanistan. He micromanaged the military and civil command structure, replacing competence with personal loyalty. Critics accused Mr. Ghani, an ethnic Pashtun, of alienating Afghanistan's other less numerous ethnic groups. He turned his back, at best, on reports of corruption in the upper echelons of his administration, allowing to flourish the same kind of graft that he had promised to clean up. On his way out of Afghanistan, he may have indulged in it himself. Russia's embassy in Kabul said on Monday that four cars were full of money as Ashraf Ghani's entourage fled, the Russian news agency RIA Novosti reported. Perhaps most disastrously over the last year, as Mr. Ghani's handling of his top military leadership, leaving in office a defense minister so crippled by injuries from a suicide bomb, he could hardly function. He was finally replaced in June, but with a grizzled veteran from another age of combat. His temper flared continuously. Cabinet ministers described President Ghani given to shouting at them during meetings, publicly humiliating those he needed to work with. He had an Afghanistan in his mind that existed in the briefings he got, said Khalid Payenda, his former finance minister who left the country 8 days ago. Right up until the end, even as his country was falling apart around him, Ashraf Ghani was holding meetings in which he rode his favorite hobby horses. The digitization of the country's finances and reforms in the Attorney General's office. People were afraid of his temper, afraid of being ridiculed in public, so people were afraid to give honest feedback, Mr. Payandir said. Good people left. Those who clung to power were either very loyal or very corrupt. In the meantime, he nurtured a curious substitute for his lack of popularity, a personalization of power in which images of himself were plastered everywhere in the capital, Kabul. The Afghan public gave no evidence of subscribing to the image Mr. Ghani attempted to project of himself, an omniscient public servant bound to make the wisest choice for his constituents because of his sizable intellect. It was a tone-deaf tack for a man whose two electoral victories were marred by widespread fraud. In both instances, American officials had to intervene to preserve at least the appearance of legitimacy. Yet for all his smarts, Ashraf Ghani often displayed a remarkable lack of self-awareness. As his statement defending his decision to flee as an act of noble self-sacrifice spread among the Afghans, a clip from a television interview he gave with the BBC in 2016 also began making the rounds on social media. Asked about the tens of thousands of Afghans who were then fleeing to Europe, Ashraf Ghani said they were impoverishing their families and undermining Afghanistan's future. I have no sympathy for them, he said.